Good evening, everyone. It's Wednesday night. It's 7 o'clock, and this is the ABD. This is our second class in exploring the work, The American Book of the Dead by E.J. Gold. And helping guide us tonight is Pat Elizabeth, who briefly was here last week, but she brings a lot to the table. And I think that I want to make sure everybody's in their seats, their shiny faces, their hands washed. And Pat, I was wondering if you could get us started.
What I'd like us to start with this evening would be to put your hands next to your face without touching, similar to having a little bit of a picture frame that frames your face. And then I want you to try this. Let the frame get bigger. Let the frame get smaller. Draw your hands further away from your face and pull your hands closer to your face. Now, let's do that horizontally. Pull the picture frame out to the side, elongate, and bring it in very tight, close frame. Now, put your hands down and allow your vision to do the same as what you just did with your hands. Adjust the view so that it is the long view, wide angle. And now allow yourself to have the close view. Right on the other side of your eyeball. Switch back to the wide angle view. Diffuse the vision, allow the eyesight to fill the whole screen with nothing particular. And pull the vision back to whatever is normal for you. And thank you very much for doing this. I appreciate it, and I feel that you're much more in contact with us all together now.
Part of our job is that we each come together as we can. We're not physically located together, but we can apply our attention and work with our attention to get into this particular space. I know that some of you have that your space that you're working from right now is really a form of an altar space. And it is a space that you've got a lot of mileage on it. So observe that space also right now. That's where we're going to be getting. But just before we get into the reading for tonight, I've got a little something I'd like to read. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but our just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove. He knew no haste. And I had put away my labor and leisure too for his civility. And that's the beginning of a poem by Emily Dickinson. It's a conversation that is just throughout all the aspects of civilization. We start to see somewhere someone is talking about this experience and we're going to get into it here. And we're using a book that we spoke about last week, some of its origins. And I'll be getting more into weaving through the Tibetan Book of the Dead and how it's related and where it came from and some of its foundation. So we're fortunate enough to have an individual put in my opinion, a great deal of work to present to present the material in such a way that we're able to access it. Where we're going to start, and we're going to take a little while, and by that I mean probably a few classes to get through the material. We're going to start with part of the front matter. And so we're going to start on page in Roman numerals 13, and it's called the author's preface. And, there's a nice little header here. Hello, I've come to say I cannot stay. I must be going. I'll stay the weekend, though. I'll stay the weekend through. I'll stay a week or two. But I'm telling you, I must be going. Of course, that's quotes from Mark. This is really a book I didn't want to write. They all say that, but I really mean it. If there had been anything I could have done to avoid it, I would have. And when I read that, I take it at its face.
Me too.
I just take it as if there had been anything I could have done to, so, but he nevertheless did write it. And this was in the 70s, and last week we talked about the fact that there really were very few cogent translations at that time. And so now this particular author came through and something impelled him. And if we listen to some of the tapes on why, you know, how I wrote it, he talks about being in the community in Los Angeles, Southern California mainly, working, and people were doing a particular type of hospice work, and they were working with the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and it didn't take.
Right. It didn't make sense. There was no cultural context. There was no associative language familiarity. It was a difficult transition to try and leap from Americana 1970 to whatever era you wish to place the lineage in that they were reading, which Evan Wentz more than likely writes.
It was the first translation in the 20s.
Yes.
You know, for years I really believed everyone knew all about this stuff. And that's another hurdle for, and it's a really great phrase that he brings in there, because it's a hurdle for everybody, for all of us together, because I know that there's an enormous spectrum tonight of learning, of skill sets, of scholarly research, of people that are just beginning this sort of thing. And there are people that are listening and reading that are not readers as such. They're not formative thinkers.
Right. They don't have that as their normal.
That's not how they
interaction.
Process.
Yeah.
And so we have to respect all of that, and we start to form a group then, and we're all in this together. We really are. We're fortunate in that we're here.
We're here. We're sitting here. We're actually here in this now. And for many, many folks, we are here in a now that will extend through some periods of time, which some of us may not actually be alive for. But when this is heard, seen, watched, and most especially interacted with, then you're going to be able to touch some of this material. I just want to comment also on what you're saying. I really believed everyone knew all about this stuff and that they were joking when they claimed no knowledge. Again, I'm taking that at face value, but I'm also paying attention to the word joking, because it seems as if it could be something like a laughing matter that you would have a whole Western civilization that claimed to not have this particular understanding of existence.
And nevertheless, that's what not only, and you know, I want to say that in the last 30 years, certainly, there's been an enormous push and movement in the hospice movement. It's an enormous movement even here in San Francisco, which is close to us, a couple hundred miles. You know, there's this enormous Zen hospice movement. There's a lot of work. There's an enormous amount of literature out there. There wasn't. But even though the literature is out there, and as my new friend Judy and George can attest, there's literature out there that's been there, and there it is, and yet it's untapped. And so part of our work is to tap that, and we're tapping it in part through speaking it. I was happy to read something that was written about the vivifying effect.
Bringing it to life.
Bringing it to life, the vivifying effect of speaking it. And we'll recall that the Tibetan, that even though Evan Wentz called it the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the true name of it, or the more acceptable name, and there's a whole study on the name, but the true name is Great Liberation Through Hearing.
Yes.
In the Bardas.
Yes.
Through Hearing in the Bardas. So that's where we're headed with this, and that's partly where we're going. And then jumping ahead a little bit. And I discovered that this teaching had been neglected completely and then finally lost in the Western world.
Yeah.
Of course, there's a lot of folks around now to help out with it. Tibetans arrived here in large numbers. They have the knowledge, but they don't have the language skills and certainly not the cultural, psychological background to communicate this knowledge to Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what we're doing also is if we put in the kind of effort and we bring to it the attention that I know some individuals that I know very well are bringing at this moment to this, we're garnering something that then we can be a bit of a conduit for sharing with others, Pat.
And I think one of the things that happens is if there is a receptivity to the flow of something that has been enlivened, it actually, as it passes through you, enlivens you even further so that you can continue to participate with an active, active, meaningful, persistent sort of, you know, all-encompassing engagement with the material. That's the vivifying effect. It vivifies you in relation to the teaching. It also vivifies the teaching in relation to you. It's a reciprocal situation. It's a very potent force, speaking the teaching.
And then since the original publication of this manuscript, the teaching has arrived in the form of many refugees and visitors from far and near east. Like all things, there's a reason for that, too. Just as the lobes of the human brain periodically transfer activity from one to the other, left to right and right to left, so does the teaching, the Dharma, transfer from one hemisphere of the world to the other. Every 600 or 700 years, like clockwork, the Dharma, the spirit of the living earth, transfers west to east to west, thus the male and female principles, teachers of the age, appear from time to time in the east. In the east, and we're not talking about Boston, the 10th avatar has already come and gone, so came to the end for Dharma in the east. Now, for the next 600 years, there will appear in the West. So it is settling on the West, and by this we mean, you know, the Western European culture that we're all imbued with, and we've taken rebirth in this particular zone. You know, this is where we are. Kukuls, avatars, holy ones, parents of the sun and of the mother, endlessly nudging human primates to dig themselves out of sleep, and for some, a very few, there will be an awakening, and for the rest, a religion, and maybe even several religions. Meanwhile, in the East, humanity will sleep a while, wrapped in the thin comfort of high technology. Their waking day is finished for the moment, but never fear, the time will come again when it is their turn to hold the Dharma, their turn to hold the spirit within the world, their turn to labor in the world of being, and your turn to grab some shut-eye. 10 avatars will come. Each will take a rightful turn in the efforts to maintain the waking state, thus earning a period always far too short of rest and relaxation. The time for each avatar is set by law, and thus their dawning and setting is determined. Now, the time of the first avatar, we call Yotel, has come, and the first tukus are already here. We will be with you for the next 600 years. Then we will leave. Our task will have been completed. So this book is the result of the usual combination of teaching, being taught, and experience with these sets and their consequences.
No, with these states.
These states. Thank you.
Yes.
And consequences. Actually, there are quite a few individuals around who do not know about these things. As you'll soon discover, if you begin to fool around and actually experiment with these states and ideas, it just may occur that as you learn to handle death and rebirth, you may learn how to handle life in the process. This is unavoidable. And if by chance you do happen to handle life better because of it, don't despair, you'll never get out of it alive. So for me, as I've said many times in the last several years, in the very narrow sense that I mean it, these works are incomplete. In a sense, the works that we've been studying of E.J. Gold are incomplete from the point of view that they get their completion by the work we do with the material.
Absolutely. It is not a doctrine. It is a teaching, and that word has an ing on the end of it. That means it's a gerund. That means it's in motion. It is in process. It is proceeding. It is not a static thing. It is an ongoing.
Several years ago, I was in New York doing the IAJE art show with a big jazz event, and we were presenting art throughout. It was just a magnificent situation. And as luck would have it, I was there. Linda actually had come down from Montreal. To help out, and she was there. And we were talking to a professor from Columbia University who happened to be there for the jazz. And we were talking about a particular artist, and I can't remember his name. It starts with a B. He's a jazz artist. Yeah, Ivan would remember him. But the artist felt very, very, very cogently that his art was not complete until the viewer viewed it. So in the same way, our job, and everybody that's here this evening, our job is to work with this material. We're reading it right now. What we're doing is we're getting in the mood.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a presentation of mood, sort of like a wonderful buffet that you sample a few tastes and you rinse your palate and you inhale and you breathe in and you're getting just the beginning of the sense of the mood of the where the text can take you. I'd like to read the next sentence. These readings for the Voyager are the direct teachings of the guides. Perhaps you think of them as teachers, Sufis, Arhats, Bodhisattvas. and the instructions have been rendered into modern American usage. If you have any trouble following and applying these instructions, you might want to inquire through the publisher about further study material which expands the subject and treats it more in depth and detail. Now, you should remember, I love this language, you should remember the state that a voyager in the labyrinth gets into while still attached to a biological machine, as well as between lives in the non-biological macro dimensions. Boy, is that ever a mouthful.
Yeah, we're going to parse that sentence a little bit.
Great.
Okay. So, and I appreciate the vocalization and the depth that Pat brought to the concept of remember. And that has more meaning for me than the linear memory of my events when I was 13 or
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a memory, and I'm not being mystical here and saying, oh yeah, I remember my lives when I was this and this and all of this. No, I'm talking about specific events in this lifetime that we have had that we, once we open ourselves to a different sensibility, we will remember, oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a very, we'll get into that right toward the very end of the class.
Perfect.
But nevertheless, I wanted to point that out, that the voyager in the labyrinth, while still attached to a biological machine, that's us.
That's us.
That's me. As well as between lives and the non-biological macro dimensions. So that this is the first time that the author is implying to us that in the labyrinth as a voyager attached to the biological machine.
Yes.
Okay? It rolls out.
It's rolled out in the context of remembering the state of a voyager.
Right.
It's not to remember some experience, it's to remember the state of a voyager. The state of a voyager is the, think about it like if you're traveling on the water, if you're on the ocean, you have several modes of transport. You could be in an ocean liner. You could be in a canoe. You could be on a raft. You might be holding to the top of a dolphin. You are moving in some state. The state in which the voyager in the labyrinth gets into while still attached to the biological machine, as well as, get this, the tween lives in the non-biological macro dimensions. So that's like a whole lot of components in one phrase. It's not even the whole sentence yet.
Yeah, and that, so, and we talked about the concept of Bardo and the between state
mm-hmm.
a little bit last class. We introduced it, and we'll deepen it again this particular class. So it's a state of extreme lucidity. Even when you're in the biological machine,
mm-hmm.
as a voyager, if you are standing there as a pure voyager, there's a state of extreme lucidity. And I think that over the next few weeks, I won't demonstrate that to you, but I believe that you will be able to demonstrate that to yourself.
Yes, you are welcomed and invited and encouraged and supported in allowing yourself to experience the state of lucidity of a voyager. That is a safe and acceptable experience to have even in a biological machine.
Okay? So don't worry if you have trouble understanding the meaning of the text. Okay? If you have trouble understanding the meaning of the text, because the Voyager in the labyrinth, with that all-embracing clarity of vision and understanding, won't have that problem. Let's see, what was it called again? Great liberation through hearing.
Yes.
In the Bardas, okay? Mm-hmm. it's only in the form of human primate living in the lower dimensions that we need footnotes. And we've left behind. We're in a different zone now, Pat. Okay.
I would say footnotes would be of no value. Foots even actually probably don't carry much weight around here, if I may make a punny.
In time I'll expand more about the Tibetan Book of the Dead, some of its more of its lineage and its title. There's a whole discussion about its title, and it's actually a series of books in that particular title. But I was, you know, the next page, if we turn to the next page, we see in big, bold letters there's this another, once again, American Book of the Dead. And it got me thinking, because I was studying all this stuff about the title of the Tibetan Book of the Dead a while ago when I was reading some of the Evan Wentz stuff and other material. Why is this called the American Book of the Dead? I always thought maybe it was, why not the modern Book of the Dead?
Mm-hmm.
Or the current Book of the Dead,
mm-hmm.
or the enhanced, the new,
mm-hmm.
shiny.
Revised.
The revised Book of the Dead.
Sure.
And I was wondering, is George still here? Is he on?
Yes, I am.
I was wondering, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, those familiar with my orientation, I was introduced to the Fourth Way teaching through Gurdjieff's teachings, and after somewhat mastering them, I became acquainted with EJ's books and felt that EJ's books are a logical extension of the fundamental ideas that Gurdjieff had laid down. And in his book, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, one of the chapters entitled America, I gradually grew to presume was kind of the birth of our essential self from the orientation of our biological machine. So America, in Gurdjieffian terminology, deals with the essential self as a increasingly self-sufficient and independent part of our own personal trinity. And so as I read this book by EJ, this is just my own personal opinion, I thought, oh, geez, I see. EJ probably, and since this is one of EJ's earliest books, it was simply American Book of the Dead, the essential self has separated itself from the biological machine and that center of gravity and orientation, and recognizes that the ego has died, so to speak, and now the essential self is trying to make sense of it all. What the hell was I ever doing in there, and what the hell have I been doing up to the point of this so-called rebirth?
Bravo, in 25 words or less, that's the essential teaching of the title of all of those books.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And frankly, the rest of those secret talks with Mr. G begin to talk about how the essential self can invoke itself in order to experience different parts of the labyrinth as an intelligent entity.
Yes.
So, to quote Dorothy.
Oh, please. We're not in Kansas anymore?
We're not in Kansas anymore.
Thank you.
So as I've said a number of times, and I'll probably say it many times, and some people are new to this, but is that you we are not beginners. We're skilled operatives working now together. You know, we've come together, and because of that, in a certain way, we're going to acknowledge the fact that, yes, for the period of time that we're focusing on this kind of material, we are voyagers. We're going to begin as voyagers. We're going to attempt to stand in that position. Each of us, in a certain way, is in their own little altered temple looking at a computer screen. But we acknowledge, some of you, I know, because I asked this a while back, you have a candle, you have incense. The place is set forth in a certain way. And you've put time into that space, because that's where, in a sense, you come to pray. And we bring that together. That's what we bring together. And now, in that space, with great boldness, I say, we stand together and we come together and we say, okay, now what do we see about us? And our source of focus for the moment and for a little while is going to be this book, The American Book of the Dead. So, thank you for that, George.
I'd like to add something, Dave. This is Judy.
Yeah, hi, Judy.
Hi, about what George said. Gurdjieff is very clear that essence is influenced by factors such as where we're born, astrology, the geography and culture of the people, and our early education. And basically that people's language, the language itself and the folk stories evolve from that culture and those types. So I think EJ is quite brilliant here in what he's done, because the Avi has a very clear understanding that an American, to embrace the Tibetan Book of the Dead from the vantage point of that culture, would not bring the same kind of benefit, because our being would not have the context to operate in that space. So what he's created is a book that takes into account what an American is and how an American thinks, or perhaps the psychology of how we develop, to put something in a languaging that we can relate to, so that he can share this material. And that's why I think he calls it the American Book of the Dead. It's the Book of the Dead so that an American can understand it or can relate to it, not in an intellectual level, but he's put it together in a way that we can relate on the level of our inner being coming from this culture.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Reminded of the fact that in addition to the context of the American culture, we also have the fact of the storyteller, the tale, the myth bringer, the scribe, the bearer of the teaching in whatever form that is. And I think most of you know that EJ's father was H.L. Gold, the science fiction writer and creator of the magazine Galaxy. So the context of EJ's childhood as a learner of the language of the culture was with the likes of Isaac Asimov and others, and his relationship to the use of the written word and the evocation of a mental journey as what you get in a book is one that he had the experts at his, you know, shall we say, bedside storytelling time. So the culture of the learning of the author has to do with the presentation of the culture that the American has in relation to the language that it uses. And that's the other aspect to this for me.
And in the reading that we were just doing, he refers to this, I don't know what it's called, but I'm sure I'm not pronouncing it right, but it's
Yoyocoyotl.
And that's a storyteller.
Exactly.
It's the coyote, but it's also the trickster, prankster, etc., but a storyteller, too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And we'll see that a lot as we go through here. And so, yeah, the text, but it's the story. Mm-hmm. So that invokes, and that's going to create, we're going to stand in a different place
mm-hmm.
when we look at this material.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
So,
would you have a couple of comments?
Please, Susan, go for it.
Well, Hadir said layman's terms.
Layman's terms?
Yes.
Can you focus this in a little bit more, Vagir, please?
There's another comment by Laura Leanne.
Yes.
That says American language is different from British English. The similarity is confusing.
Okay.
And Pathworld adds, bloody well is, mate.
Yeah. And can you read that? Vadir, can you tell us more a little bit about your question, please? Or type it in. I'm not sure where it's going, but
Okay. She says the Tibetan book is written in layman's terms because you don't need to know spiritual lingo to understand it.
Correct. That you're right. And the Tibetan Book of the Dead was worked with, practiced by Tibetans who were imbued in that culture.
Yes, the whole culture.
So they were imbued in a culture. As this goes on, I'll read some of the passages from the Tibetan Book of the Dead as written and more modern translations that have come. And you'll see, there's a wonderful tone to it. There really, really, really is.
Yeah, it's lighthearted.
David,
there's another comment that's pretty interesting.
Go ahead, Harry.
Layman's terms might reach the mechanical mind, whereas story and myth coming from the essence of the people reaches the deeper non-formative part of us.
Who is that?
That was Scafudi.
Judy.
That's Judy.
That's
yeah.
Judy.
So each of us has, yeah, this is, we've talked a lot about sensing and the kind of attention that we've been working with. We bring our sensing to this particular event. No matter what we're reading in the text, it is our cumulative efforts together to help us hold the space of the storyteller,
mm-hmm.
of the myth maker.
Mm-hmm.
We are in the midst at this moment of making this, coding ourselves in the myth that we will carry with us as we go forward. Okay?
There was one more
go ahead.
Piece here that I think we could go ahead and
yeah.
add, which is the last paragraph.
Go ahead. Very good.
And, by the way, if you're wondering about the source of this book, it comes directly from the source of all books. In the labyrinth, you'll notice, if you notice anything at all, that all books are the same book and that they all say the same thing. Don't look around for someone else to hang it on. You are the source. I think that states very clearly what you were just saying about all of us making this myth, being in this campfire space, sitting with our shoulders touching each other in the glow of the flames, just barely warming our cheeks and faces. It's too dark to see anybody distinctly, but we can see you there. We feel you there with our shoulders.
Yeah.
We're contributing our words and our piece here. You are the source. I am the source. We are the source.
George, you recall we had a conversation over the last 2 weeks, I can't remember exactly which one it was, where we talked about the concept of getting to a school. Do you remember this?
Yes, I do.
Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, Dave, we were talking about what it means to enter a school. And I had indicated that my understanding had grown and evolved over time, so that initially when we think of a school, we think of it in traditional literal terms, finding a weekend seminar or a course of instruction in some location over a period of time. But what I've gradually come to see is that as our essential self develops and acquires a certain degree of self-sufficiency, it enters a school in the macro dimensions, actually. That is to say that it becomes sensitized to different bodies of knowledge, which enlarge its comprehension or understanding of a particular area and prepares it and suits it for a particular work effort on behalf of all beings. And so I was saying that maybe a school is not necessarily made of bricks and mortar, but kind of like the internet, I suppose, it's an ethereal place that we can enter once our essential self has developed to a certain level of maturity and stability. All this in accordance with what E.J. writes brilliantly about in Human Biological Machine and Life in a Labyrinth.
So, Rachmaninoff has a piece called Rhapsody on a Theme from Paganini. It's just a fabulous piece, and there's this section toward the end of it. I wish I was a musician so I could describe it to you better, but there's this, it's like there's this buildup. He does this remarkable buildup, and once you think that you've reached the pinnacle of what he's telling you in this music, and then he goes to another level. And I thought, wow. But I realized that I couldn't have appreciated that last tonality if he hadn't helped me build up to this other point. That's what we're doing right now. We're setting the ground in these first few classes. We're setting the ground, and we're working together to practice bringing our essential selves and offering that to the fire of this invocation that we're doing together. Because once we get to that level, there's something that we're supposed to grab. Maybe we don't know. In fact, we don't know what it is. Is Gnostic Man on there?
Yeah.
We don't know what it is, brother. But have faith in the fact that your inner work has been such that your habits will carry you through. Your habits of work and attention and your great sensing that we've been working with over all this time that you've been working with, we'll find what we are to find.
When we have that phrase that says, all phenomena is illusion, neither attracted nor repelled, not making any sudden moves, even if none of those three phrases can go any further because we haven't yet come to that. We still have my habits will carry me through. We still have that. We still have the body of habits. In fact, some of the phraseology and the vocabulary and the structure of the next couple of hundred pages that you're going to read, and probably over and over and over again, are going to have some touching reminder, some little tickle that's going to go, oh, yes, that, I got that, yes, I can relate. That's your habit. That is the body of habits. That's your essential self bringing you along in full awareness in present time and space, and fortunately for all of us, with everyone here.
Everyone here.
Together.
Yeah, and the together part is very important. It's proper, it's okay, and there is space to ask any question that may come up, because it's important that we move as well as we are able together.
Absolutely.
I'm going to suggest that we not continue on to the next wonderful, just couple
good.
Of pages, which
that's
is
good.
Called Notes on the Labyrinth, which I suggest that you continue to you read that, because there's some housekeeping things I'd like to go over. Okay?
Did you really mean housekeeping?
Yeah, I really...
You meant campfire keeping, right?
I we'll see what I mean in a minute.
Okay.
So the first thing I want to point out is I'm just going to point it out. One of the tasks that I suggested is that we do this thing, the last hours, planning the last hours of life, you know, what would you like it to be like? And I was taken out to the woodshed on that one by some earlier today, and that's okay. But there are now two entries and up on the website, and they're both quite wonderful. If you want to go and take a look at them, there's a poetry to what these two individuals have shared with us, and there's actually a third one that I'll post, which is a one-liner. I won't give it to you now, but I'm going to post it anyway, and I'll post that in the next few days or so. Take the time to look at it. And the individuals are looking for feedback, but they're also, there's a, back to this comment that, you know, there's a whole idea of verbalization, okay, and the vibratory impact of that that I'm listening very carefully to my new friend about here, but it's this vibratory effect of it. Now, these two individuals have put something up there. Whatever they put up there is what they put up there. In sharing it, in a sense, they're speaking it, but that they've made it public. They've taken it out of their little house and brought it out there, and for me, that's a form of confession on a higher level. Like confession, we usually think, I did this wrong, and I hit my sister, and I kicked my dog, and stuff like that. Confession is, in a sense, I am no longer a human biological machine. I am an essential self, and these individuals put their rod in the earth, and they said, this is where I stand now. So there's a number of reasons to do that exercise. And do we understand it at all? No. But it's from this space that we can begin to look at it from this space. Okay? That's one thing. You go to where it says last hours of life, and you're going to see two little headings come up, and you can click on both of them, either one of them, and see what you think about it. The last thing I want to go over is I made a comment in the email about the rebirth stations. And this also, I was, brought to bear, brought you know, someone gave me a lashing about it, which I needed. But I nevertheless, I'm going to say it anyway. What I want you to all consider is you go to Appendix C. Not, you know, you can do it now if you want, but Appendix C, which is on page 181, and you look through that, and there are Bardo stations, and it indicates that they're written there. But don't forget these are words. And they point to something, and what they're pointing to is they're literally pointing to somebody, and then the author is sitting there and he goes, how am I going to point to that? I get it. Let me try words. I'm going to try words. What do you think? And, you know, it's got positives and negatives and all of that, because don't forget they're words. But if these are not meant to be, use your formatory thinking, your logical brain to get to them. You read them. And I'm going to ask all of us to read through these a few times. You know, we've read them a number of times, of course, but read through them at some point, and this is also an almost impossible instruction, and maybe you can help me with this, but I'm going to give it anyway, okay?
Okay.
And if I'm mistaken, it's okay. And this has to do with the concept of remembering. If we read through these, not like we read through it, like a quick list, you go, oh yeah, that one. But you read through it and you pause a minute. You pause. There's a little meditation involved. There's a considering of it. And you're going to see one, two, three, some of them, something will be there. There may be, it may be, and it may not be, that one of them suddenly says to you, oh my God, I remember when I was living up in Massachusetts for a while, and I was in this school, I was at this college, and that's what happened to me. So we may, you know, this is a form of recalling that has to do with the same event that you can talk to your mom about, but then suddenly you saw it in a whole new realm.
So let's pose the question in this way. If I was to look at one of the rebirth stations that have been jotted down here, I'm just gonna pick the title of one and ponder Grand Hotel. If I was to allow myself to encourage the remembrance that I have to come closer so that I can notice it, what would that look like to me? And then I'm going to say, turn of the century Victorian hotel. Large corridors, neutral, cage elevators. Now, for me, there's one in the back room there, not in the head. Yeah, I'm gagging in my throat here, cage elevators, okay? I don't need to read any more of these words. I've got that. I'm going to let that be with me for a while. I'm not going anywhere else. I'm going to just be in that, just that. So for yourself, whatever method works for you, tease. What's that thing kids do to each other that's a little...
I don't know.
You know.
I know what it is, though.
That's the thing that kids, you know.
They needle each other.
You know, it's like you're almost irritating enough to want to be slapped, but it's still a game. That's what you want. You want to encourage and allow whatever remembrance you have to be present close enough for you to get the picture. That's all.
He got me at the Grand Hotel.
Yeah, well.
I almost fell out of my chair. Anyway, so, taunt.
Thank you.
Taunt is, taunt. Thank you, Mark.
Yes.
So, do we have a question, Susan?
Yes, we have one last, we do have one last question.
Good.
Esther says, I keep looking for a remedy for my relentless nagging ego. Is the ABD a form of remedy?
Yes.
And then Mark Circa says, if you can use it.
Yeah, if you can use
the
magic cure
is you, but whatever you have in your hands can be a good friend and take you places you might not otherwise go.
Susan, go back and just read what Bhattra said.
I keep looking for a remedy for my relentlessly nagging ego.
Oh.
Is the ABD a form of a remedy?
Yes, in the homeopathic sense.
Well, a couple of years ago, I was informed that Bhattra had gone to a physical, extreme physical trauma.
Yes.
Extreme physical trauma. And for some reason, I was asked, I wasn't even asked. It was just, that was revealed to me. And so I started, and somebody else took him in and helped him with convalescence.
Yes.
For a period of time. And I started doing readings for this individual. And it was maybe the strongest, I can remember right this minute, connection I had.
Yeah.
When I would say the words, now I am experiencing the clear light of objective reality. Okay? Because that mood was the conduit when I was doing that reading for that individual.
Yes, and the remedy, a homeopathic remedy does not get rid of symptoms. A homeopathic remedy acknowledges and matches exactly the symptoms in their reciprocity. So a remedy for an ego. Remedy for an ego. Think about that. What is the remedy for ego?
You know, this is...
I'm not going to say.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Judy. When I said that was a brilliant statement, I mean, there's a lot to this, and thank you for that, because the homeopathic sense is the matching of vibration.
Right.
And also that it's in very small doses. And we need to understand that this happens in small incremental changes. So the whole idea of it being homeopathic is a very good concept to carry lightly as we go through this. Thank you for that.
Very nice term. Nicely put.
We're going to lightly approach this. And there's a reason why, which we'll get into in time, but we are able to do that. We're just kind of pointing to some things. We're pointing to it. And we're going to see how we shall come to those things. Okay?
I would like to share the last couple comments.
I would like you to do that.
Okay.
Because Mark Circa responded to Bhattra and said, if you can use it, asking if it was a remedy, and then goes on to say, the magic cure is you, but whatever you have in your hands can be a good friend and take you places you might not otherwise go.
Great. Very good. Very good, Mark.
And then a comment from Mark Roach. He said, that's right, it would seem so. In any event, there are lots and lots of remedy orbs which would probably address one way or the other what you brought up.
So
that's helpful. That's a helpful thing, yes. Any more?
One last one from Judy. She said, I mean to hold it lightly in our consciousness.
Right.
To be kind. To be kind to ourselves as we work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. Anything else? Is that about it, Susan?
Yeah, it seems to be. I don't think I've missed anything,
good,
Harry.
Good.
No,
I think you've gotten everything.
Okay.
This class for tonight, and I want to thank everybody for coming, and it's so nice to see you again. And we'll take next week at 7 o'clock Wednesday night, and we'll continue our working our way through the ABD.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.